Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Welcome to the State of Sound recording studio, here at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. I don't use this word often, but we have the legendary Terry Hemmer.
Use it often either.
Inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame in 2010, right?
Yeah. I guess so. I can't keep track.
Thank you so much for coming down.
Well, thank you. And, I'm with the legendary Dave Hoekstra here.
Oh, yeah. We try. We're going to do a group interview.
I've read a lot of your stuff over the years. You know, I feel like I know you.
Well, thank you. Got John Langford's going to ask some questions.
Well, I'm a fan of his, too. But he knows that.
This wouldn't happen without Lance Towser, the director of exhibits and shows here at the Lincoln Museum.
So are you going to make history your middle name? I think you should do that, you know.
I'm going to change it tomorrow.
Yeah, okay.
So I want to just tell the listeners who's listening to this just a little bit of your career 101, and then we get into some specific questions for everybody here.
Sure.
Talk about how you got into radio, what you heard in Ohio.
Yeah, well, I grew up listening to WING in Dayton, Ohio, the Wing Lively guys. And Gene By Golly Berry was my favorite DJ because he was this white guy that loved black music, and he turned me on to it, like, at an early age, like, you know, like, I was trying to con my aunts into buying me Coaster singles. You know, it was that long ago, and I was like in grade school with no allowance, and my ear glued to the radio. And this is before even portable radios. My parents took an old console of radio from the radio television piece of furniture we used to all have, and they got somebody rewire it and then put a 45 RPM record player in the guts of it. And at night I would climb under my bed and turn it on, listen to WING at night, it was all glowing. And so I was just nuts about music. And then the Beatles came around in 1964, as Mr. Langford knows, because he painted a wonderful picture of me with the Beatles, but he had me as old as Ed Sullivan in the picture.
You were in the Beatles for a while.
I was in Hamburg.
I didn't make that stuff
in Hamburg. But I loved I didn't think I was going to like the Beatles because I thought they were going to be like four Pat Boones, you know, doing R&B covers. Like, who needs it, you know? And so I watched it as a skeptic that first week on Ed Sullivan, and I went, oh my God, these guys are really good. I kind of like them. And the third week when John Lennon sang Twist and Shout, I lost it. Because not since Elvis had I heard a white guy really sing with soul, you know. And early Elvis was spot on. Then those jumpsuits kind of ruined him. But, you know, but really amazing vocals. And you could tell they loved the music. They were paying tribute to the music. They weren't just ripping it off. So I became a Beatle nut, like, immediately. And then the next year, 65, I was in study hall with my teen magazine and my geography book, true story. And I'm reading, and Jim Stagg, who ended up on WCFL for many years, he was in Cleveland at the time, and he went on all three American tours and would interview them in every town and syndicated all over the country. And so I saw a picture, Jim Stagg interviews Ringo Starr. And I told Ringo this story a couple of years ago, and he flipped out. He loved it. I said, but a light went off over my head, and I thought, if I got to be a disc jockey, I could meet the Beatles. Because I didn't want to pull their hair or scream and run down the street after them and all that stuff. I just wanted to hang out with them. They seemed really cool. And then I didn't even stop and think that there were no women on the air, but I was just stubborn, you know. And so it was time to go to college, and I chose Elmhurst College because they had a really groovy campus radio station, you know. And and my dad, who was a plumber, very, you know, good guy, and he said, well, I support you in your dream. It's very improbable, you know, you might not make it, but I want you to give it your best shot, but have a backup plan. So I said, okay, I'll teach speech in high school and junior high if I can't make it in radio. So I majored in speech, which turned out to be a good major for what I end up doing, interview skills and all kinds of stuff, and just getting over my shyness of getting up and talking in front of people, that kind of stuff. So I graduated from Elmhurst and edited textbooks for a few months while I kept bugging WGLD at the Oak Park Arms Hotel, the underground radio station, my favorite station. This is 1970. Yeah. And I kept bugging them for a job because I didn't want to edit textbooks the rest of my life. And they finally hired me. They said to keep me from bugging them, you know. So they put me in a walk-in closet, and I answered the request line for $90 a week, and with my Bachelor of Arts degree, you know.
Yeah.
And very slowly but surely worked my way out of that walk-in closet, because really, like this time of year, fall, people come hang up their coats and say good morning to me, because I was literally in a walk-in closet. And by the end of the 2 years, I was doing all kinds of making work, you know, in this in the programming department. And then they started putting me on fill-ins, and I thought, ooh, I could make this, you know, this is going to happen. And my boss one day came out. He was kind of a bully, and he was watching me work my rear end off, because I was a hard worker, and I worked really hard and made stuff up, made it a better radio station, I think. And I learned a lot about radio from that too. That was great. But he came out one night, and he was watching me work, like, and he laughed. He said, "You think you're going to make it, don't you?" And I said, "Well, you know, that's what I want to do, and there are no guarantees, but I'm on my way, I think." And he goes, "You don't have what it takes. You're never going to make it." And I went home, almost cried. And I thought, you know, I was 24 years old. And I thought, oh, you know, because they had a woman on GLD, which was so radical. But they said, we can't have two women on GLD. My God, be reasonable. So I thought, I'm just going to have to hang it up. And I tell my students this story at Columbia College. And I said, he went on to be the general manager of a station in Florence, Alabama. And I'm in the rock and roll effing hall of fame. And so sometimes somebody will tell you crap like that, and just remember your teacher told you. So it was an uphill battle, but finally made it.
And I don't want to gloss over that. I mean, there's just a story in the news just last week about the Milwaukee Bucks hiring the first female announcer, play-by-play announcer.
Big deal.
2021. Look what you were doing in the late 60s and early 70s.
It was so pretty crazy.
I mean, talk about how you touched on that there, but how challenging that was for you, and also what you said about your parents, your parental support.
Yeah, that meant the world to me, you know. And, well, even at the campus station, I encountered sexism from my peers, you know. I mean, it was a miracle that I got to be program director, and I finally had to drop that because I got on academic probation because I was spending too much time at the station. And I was in a singing group called the Buckets, and we were killing it. And so we were busy. We had the Buckets. Yeah, well, it was the Ass Buckets, but then we decided we'd never get our name on a poster, so we dropped it to Buckets. And then the Ass Ponies came around years later, and I thought, man, you know, oh, the Buckets, that's a whole other story. We're still soul sisters together. So anyway, no, even in college radio, and I had to put up with, they wouldn't let me do a rock show because they said, well, girls don't do rock shows. I went, what do you mean girls don't do rock? I can carry a big milk crate of records. I can handle that. And I had to start off with a mood music show. And I thought, mood is like dinner music, you know, the Living Strings play Lennon McCartney, you know. So, and I started reading poetry over and doing really campy crap, you know. And I got a following, and then people were just like demanding I do a rock show. So I finally got to do a rock show. But no, it was really crazy. And then when I was trying to get a job in radio, I heard things like, well, nobody wants to listen to a woman on the radio, and women don't have good voices, and women especially don't like to listen to other women, and men, you know, like, well, you remember WSDM, yeah, that was around for, and everybody said, you know, a couple of years later, that was all female DJs. And I said, you should apply there. And I said, I don't want to, because then I'll be stereotyped. You know, because the cliche at the time was that you had to sound like you just had a great night of sex. You know, like, you know. And it was either that or you had to be twice as smart as every man. You're like, rah, 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 I'm, you know, and I'm going to burn my bra right here on the studio. Yeah. You know, and I thought, I don't feel comfortable with either one of those. And it was Yvonne Daniels who I heard when she was on CFL doing a Sid and Yvonne, and then later on she went on to SDM. But Yvonne Daniels really inspired me because she was a true pioneer, and she doesn't get enough credit for it. And she sounded like herself. And I thought, that's how I want to sound. Not like Yvonne Daniels. I want to sound like myself. Now, what does that sound like? It's like playing the guitar. You know, you start out like in B.B. King, and so you play like B.B. King, and then all of a sudden you realize you got to sound like yourself. And what does that sound like? You have to find your voice. And that sounds like a cliche, but it's a process. It's hard because you're kind of crazy. You're sitting in a room all by yourself, talking into a microphone. People, you can't hear the response. luckily. And it's kind of crazy. How do you, you know, stand-up comedy, at least you can see what the response is, and you can respond to that. I had a guy from the Score once that told me, oh, I could be on XRT. That'd be easy. I could just say, another record by the Pretenders on XRT, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, let me on the Score. It's a sports radio station talk. And I said, give me a sidekick and two producers and a phone lighting up with calls. I could talk about sports till the sun goes down, sure. You know. Yeah. I mean, you know, you try sitting in a room by yourself and have a personality. Yeah. That's tricky. So, and then I left GLD finally because I realized I wasn't going to get anywhere there. And I went to WCMF in Rochester, New York. Right. Actually, Tom Tuber, a friend of mine from Elmhurst College, we made a blood pact. That was back before HIV, so you could actually cut and exchange fluids and not worry about it. But we said, whoever gets in the radio first are going to hire the other one. And he was a year older than me, and so he hired me. So I did all nights there for 2 years. And then one of the people at the station decided they wanted to have carnal knowledge of the only female DJ. And I said, no, thank you. And I was very polite about it. No harm done. But he got me fired. Yeah. And so I came back here with nothing and certainly no money. I wasn't making any money. But I was on midnight to six nights a week. And that was great. That was my Hamburg. Like the Beatles played Hamburg.
Are you talking about XRT?
Yeah, no, it's at CMF.
Okay, there.
And that, like the Beatles would play 6 hour sets. Mm-hmm. And that's where I learned my craft. Because when you're on the air that long, if you don't get it by then, you're going to plumbing. Yeah, I would have joined my dad's plumbing company. But then I came back without a job and destitute, and XRT was just starting up, and they were three guys who I'd known at GLD. I'd met them at GLD, John Platt, Seth Mason, and Bob Schulman. And they knew that I'd work really, really hard for very little money, so they said, stick around, we were trying to make a position for you, so they hired me part-time, and then finally full-time. But I was on the All Night Show for like 7 years, and then
that's
finally,
my first heard you, I think.
Yeah, so, and that was a lot of fun, though, because anything goes. I was at a movie showing at, the Gene Siskel Film Center, and one of my former students produced a documentary that won a lot of awards on Betty Davis, the funk artist, Miles Davis's ex, and I went to watch it, and it was sold out, and I was one of three white people in the whole place, and during the Q&A, because she was there as a producer to do a Q&A, and somebody stood up and said, I just want to say that I see that Terry Hemmert from XRT's here, said she was playing funk at 3 o'clock in the morning when nobody, even black radio wasn't, and she was playing Betty Davis and Funkadelic Parliament, all that stuff. And you know, went really deep with some of that. And that was so sweet.
That was your choice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because we could play anything we wanted.
Yeah. Well, that was FM radio, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You could actually play what you wanted.
Yeah, we could, especially in Rochester. And bands would stop by, like Procol Harum and Genesis and all kinds of bands would stop by after their gigs, and we'd just sit around and talk. We did all kinds of weird stuff on the air. People at other radio stations we would play with. One night there were four of us that did all night radio in Rochester. We planned the next night at a certain time. We all four put on side three, cut two, A Bitch's Brew by Miles Davis, and that was really out there in early 70s. It still sounds progressive, but we could picture all these people going, what the heck, and then go down the dial, what, go down the, and then I have a Twilight Zone experience. So we did all kinds of stuff like that in Rochester. It was a lot of fun. But with XRT, finally somebody left and there was an opening, and I got to be on the radio when the sun was up and when people were listening. But all night radio was fun, though, because I could get away with murder.
Yeah, right.
I had a blast.
I did that weird show on XRT for a while.
Oh, you did?
It was great.
You loved, and Nick Tremulous.
That's all I wanted to do was be on really late at night and not know if anyone was actually out listening, but just be able to play whatever we wanted to play.
Well, did you know that fantastic. Musicians are frustrated DJs?
No, I am.
Because you ask a lot. Well, Elton John has come out of the closet for that. You know,
I would much rather DJ.
Really?
Because you're playing all this fantastic.
Well, that was 1970.
What happened to radio? What happened to a lot
happened to radio. That's another show.
Was it just money?
It's money, and when unfortunately, it was our President Clinton signed that paper that said that you could own as many radio stations as you wanted,
right,
that you lost the independent owners, and that you get conglomerations of corporate things and everybody sounds the same. And yeah, there's that. And it's hard with radio now because we don't compete with other radio stations as much as competing with other technologies. So it's really, it's not dying. I think radio is unique and will always have a place, but it's not dominant like it used to because there are other choices. And that's rough. So anyway,
we can talk about, I mean, I know this is important to you, and this is kind of, again, going back to what we tried to do with the exhibit, about community and sense of community, and especially now in these kind of divided and lonely times, radio can be a source of community, especially local radio and stuff.
And there's an intimacy.
I remember reading a story with you about, well, okay, I met Paul McCartney, but having the direct contact with the listeners was just as important. So mm-hmm, just talk about radio, all you guys.
Yeah.
Chance was in radio.
Right, right.
He's very shy about it. But, I mean, radio just is part, local radio is part of community.
Well, you know, to me, one of the things that I love about radio and what I think why it'll always be around is there's an intimacy in radio, and not satellite radio, but like local radio, an intimacy you can't get anywhere else. And when I was working all nights in Rochester, I was getting so many calls in the middle of the night with people this close to committing suicide, somebody took the brown acid, you know, and, you know, drug overdoses and all kinds of stuff, and crisis calls. And I finally went to the youth center in Rochester and I said, I'll make you a deal. If you put me through your training course, I'll volunteer one night a week on my way into work. And I learned a lot from that, and had some harrowing experiences with people calling up who had already slit their wrists and they wanted to hear It's a Beautiful Day, White Bird, and Die to That Song. And that's an amazing story in itself, because if I hadn't gone through the training, I would have said, oh, don't die, you have so much to live for. And she would have gone, yeah, F you. You know, and instead I yelled at her. I said, you're a coward. You know, you're a loser. Yeah. Wow. Oh, I haven't told it other than a class, but and it went on all night. She would call up and then hang up. And like I would do a novena to the patron saint of suicide prevention, please help me on this, you know. And I wouldn't buy into her crap. She wanted to hear White Bird. Remember, that song is very dramatic. And that was going to be the song, her exit song. And I said, if I play that song, that means I'm feeding into this crap. And, you know, and I was swearing like a sailor to her and just saying, you're a real coward. You know, she goes, you don't know how hard my life is. I said, boo hoo. Everybody has a, you know, I never would have thought to do that. And they didn't train me to do that. They just trained you to think in a different way and then improvise, because everybody's different. I'm not saying that would work with, I'm not advising people to do that every time, but I just had a feeling that she was having a pity party and this song would add to the drama. So finally she said, well, my mother's an alcoholic. I said, wow, how unique. I bet nobody else out there has an alcoholic parent. Get help, you know. And finally at the end, this went on for hours and I'm doing a show meanwhile, you know, and finally she called and she said, I slipped my wrists. I'm sorry, I just have to do it. And she said, will you play the song? And I said, I'll make you a deal. I'll play the song if it's a song that you hear as you get taken out by a stretcher and get to the hospital. It'll be the song that'll be the beginning of your life, not the end of your life. And she said, well, how will I know you'll play the song? I said, how will I know you'll call an ambulance? And if you don't, I'll never forgive you. Well, I would never know. But it was irrational, but it was making sense to her. And she finally, I said, call, you know, and her mother was asleep in the next room. I said, wake her up, have her call an ambulance and get out of here because you're fading. And so I played the song. And this is no lie. Then this went on for hours. And then about 5:30, about the time I'd sign off, I get a call from some woman. She goes, is Terry there? I said, speaking. Said, well, my daughter wanted me to, who are you? I said, wait, you're calling me. Who are you? And well, my daughter just got taken to the hospital and she handed me this slip of paper with Terry and the phone number. And she wanted me to call and say she's going to be okay. I said, are you her mother? And she goes, yes. And I said, if you don't get your butt into AA this morning and continue to go, we'll have this conversation another time and you won't get her in time. She'll be dead. And I said, hang up the phone and call AA right now. Get going. And I heard back from the young woman a few weeks later, and things were working out, and her mom was in AA, and she was in Al-Anon. And it just gave me chills, because I thought, you know, this kid could have died if she didn't have somebody to call at 4 o'clock in the morning. And somebody had gone through a training program too, fortunately. So that's what I love about radio and music. And now that I'm semi-retired and busier than ever, but I've gone to Facebook, and I write every night. I post something about some piece of music, and I'm learning too, because I'll go deeper and find out something I didn't know. And people are really responding. And these are people who've been listening for decades. Like, I was at Ravinia last night. People are coming up and saying, every day I read what you posted. And it's just like the cherry on top of the sundae after all these decades of listening to you on the radio. And now you're still, you know, going even further. Like, I do classical music on Wednesday, you know, and stuff I couldn't do on the radio. And so that's an outlet for me, and I can be more the teacher, you know, instead of a disc jockey. And I still teach at Columbia College.
Oh, that's nice. What all do you teach?
History of Rock and Soul. First semester is 1920 to 1969. Second one's 1970 to right now. And then the kids start teaching at the end of the semester. Then they have to get up and do oral reports, and I learn something. So it's great, you know, but I love that. And I've been there 45 years.
Columbia?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was still doing the all-night shift. It was just a couple of years after I started XRT. 48 years at XRT.
Well, this one,
that's why I'm sitting down.
I want to talk about history. I mean, how do your students approach, maybe we should just say local history, Chicago area history?
Oh, yeah.
What's your take on it? And, you know, I think about this. This wasn't on my list of questions, but I saw that Rolling Stone list of 200 top songs.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw Imagine dropping down.
Uh-huh, sure.
You wonder, like, you know, our generation, look at some of this rock and roll, like our parents, like Glenn Miller and Benny, you know, Benny Goodman.
Yeah, right, right.
I mean, how do they look at history, and how do you preserve history, how you tell history? There's all a bunch of questions.
Right. Well, we start with Louis Armstrong, and I tell him, I said, for you to understand popular music today, you need to know the history of it. And we have like this foundation, you know, the blocks that rock and soul were built on, and it's swing, big band, jazz, Dixieland, all that kind of stuff. We do a big thing on gospel music. Gospel's huge. And also country and western, folk, all that kind of stuff. And then we go from there and then start tracing it from the early 50s on. But, you know, we go from the Mills Brothers to the Ink Spots to the Temptations, you know, and see how it evolved.
Are you open to all that?
Oh, they love it. But I also teach it in the sense it's not music Trivial Pursuit. I said, I want you to know some stuff, but we will have a semester-long discussion of racism, because if you don't understand race relations, you don't understand American music. And I mean, not just black music. I mean, like John was talking about Johnny Cash earlier. Johnny Cash, you know, it's part of our DNA. It's part of our history.
Kentucky, like the Sundowners.
I tell them that the audiences were segregated, but the musicians weren't. They were listening to each other. You know, Hank Williams and the Carter family were picking up blues songs and changing them around. It was blues music for poor white people.
Great photographs of Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys on Southside jazz clubs, jazz and blues clubs, sitting in there. They're not in their Western suits. They look like kind of like... Yeah. They look really cool, and they're very sophisticated, and they've gone to listen to black music.
Yeah. Well, just last week, I showed them San Antonio Rose in that video where they're in a radio studio, and they've got, I said, this is big band swing and country music, because it, you know, they had the vocalists come out, and just like the old big band used to do, and just the whole way the song is presented, it's as much jazz as it is country and
Absolutely.
Western.
Yeah.
I wanted Lance to talk about, to plug the exhibit. I did get in the last segment we were talking about, I got an email from a guy in Texas who came to this, and he just said he couldn't believe all the different types of music that came out in Illinois. So talk about what we tried to do, especially showing the diversity in that.
Right. I mean, and anytime you do anything, you know that We set out to make an exhibit that was going to celebrate the music from Illinois, but very comprehensively. And that's why you see everything from Mavis Staples to a very scary microphone from Ministry and everything in between.
Yeah.
We also realize that we can't talk about everybody. You can't talk about everybody. And
sure.
We have people come in and say things like that they had no idea that so much music originated from the state. At the same time, you get people come in and say things like, you didn't make a big enough deal of Head East or something, you know, somebody that meant a lot to them, you know. And we knew going in that we were going to have people that were going to be just, their eyes are going to be wide open, but also some people that have very personal connections to certain music. And if we didn't celebrate them to the level that in their mind that it was going to be a travesty or something along those lines. And so we made very conscious decisions about who we were going to talk about and why. So if you and we kind of took a very pragmatic approach. So if someone like John Lankford comes around and this entire genre of alternative country music starts, there are people that are sort of at the crest of that wave. If you think about even the 90s alternative rock scene with Smashing Pumpkins, there were a lot of bands that kind of followed in behind that were from Illinois. And mm-hmm. and so we can't talk about everybody, so we need to talk about the ones that were sort of the pioneers or right. the ones that were trailblazers. And that's really, we have an amazing selection of materials from big trailblazers, as you mentioned, Benny Goodman and Miles Davis and all these people. And for us, we were trying to also be comprehensive in the state. I'm from the Chicago area, but as soon as you move to the middle of the state, there's a big bias here. They think, mm-hmm. oh, well, everything about Illinois has got to be about Chicago.
Yeah.
But we had some amazing stories like Dan Fogelberg and even Miles Davis from Alton, Illinois.
Yeah.
And so we tried to not only be comprehensive musically, sure. but also geographically, which you know, can be challenging too because the population centers in the state. But when you're approaching it from teaching a class and you're not talking about just Illinois, you're talking about
right.
From an entire nation.
Sure.
Where do you start and what sort of decisions do you make with regards to who you're going to talk about and why they're important?
Well, I start with Louis Armstrong because I think he's the first rock star. I mean, he was not the first jazz musician, but he was the one that was the star. And he broke through all kinds of barriers, not just musically, but showing up in films with Bing Crosby. You know, I mean, my God, that was amazing back then. And he had that personality, that charisma that brought that music to a lot of people. Plus, I think with Louis Armstrong, I know I resented him when I was a teenager because Hello Dolly knocked the Beatles out of the number one spot when I thought, oh, what a hokey song, you know, but I had no idea about the Hot Five and all that stuff. Okay. Or that, you know, some of his stuff was avant-garde for the time. You know, you talk to a jazz trumpet player and they'll tell you he was like inventing the whole thing as he went along, and he had this charisma. So, you know, there's just, he really was one of the ambassadors racially, not just in the United States but around the world. But I also point out to my students, like Duke Ellington and Count Basie, they weren't baptized Duke and Count. They took those names on for royalty, and they dressed impeccably. I mean, just amazing, handsome men, talented men. And that was as opposed to the blackface kind of crap that was going on, the, you know, Amos and Andy and all the minstrel, you know, stuff, all yeah. the minstrel shows and all that. And so that was such a jarring thing that we lose sight of. But I said, the fact that they presented that, and Ella Fitzgerald, just a classy woman, you know, and so talented. And I said, that was huge. And that opened up to a white audience, and they had a different way of seeing black people, and black people had a sense of pride that they didn't see, you know, before, you know, in the media. But on the other hand, they were playing these beautiful hotel ballrooms and stuff, live radio broadcasts, those before DJs and stuff and before television. So that was a big entertainment. But I was telling them just the other night, because we're in this period now, and I said, you know, they play in these halls, they had all these fans, but if they wanted a sandwich, or if they wanted to stay there and get a room for the night, or if they wanted to use the bathroom, good luck.
Right.
You know, and that's just, and the kids are like, whoa, you know, yeah. that's like Summer of Soul. We were just talking about on the way yeah. down here. That film is so good because it's not just a documentary about a great musical event, but it's history. And you can't separate the two. And I always tell my kids too that Dr. King owed a debt to baseball and music because he knew you had to pass legislation to move things along. But that's not enough. He was also a man of God, so he knew you had to work conversions of the soul. You had to convince people in the marrow of their bones to believe something and to believe that justice is right and that we need to love one another. He needed baseball and music because that's how some white kids their first experience with racism and racial awareness and all that stuff came through those. Like me being a fan of Roy Campanella and finding out that he played in the Negro Leagues because they wouldn't, made me mad as a fifth grader. I was furious. Yeah. I didn't know about that. You know, I knew he made it, but I didn't realize what he had to go through. So all that stuff with musicians and all that really brought an awareness and an empathy, because if you love Roy Campanella like I did, or if you love Ella Fitzgerald and you find out how they're treated, that changes you.
Right.
That changes the way you see the world.
Well, why'd you like Roy Campanella?
Oh my God.
I'm not a baseball guy here.
Oh, can I digress? Okay. Roy Campanella. Well, I read that biography. I love biographies. When I told you I was a history nut, but I love biographies, and I give them to those big head biographies for middle school kids now. I give them out to kids all the time because I think that's how you understand as a child how you get from there to being a successful career. You know, how do you make that transition and see how other people did it? And that book really changed my life. And then when I was in, it was really that was my first institutional awareness of institutional racism, and it changed me profoundly. And then when I was 13, I read his book, It's Good to Be Alive, because he was in that car accident and was paralyzed in a wheelchair the rest of his life. And I read this book, and it was a really honest book, because he said, I was really angry. I got a divorce. I pushed everybody away. I refused to do PT. And finally, they got to him and turned him around, and he talked about how he rebuilt his life and how he was in a chair and he wasn't feeling put upon. But Branch Rickey and his physical therapist are the two people that shook him out of that. And I read that book and I was so blown away and I was so inspired by it. And shortly after it, I was diagnosed with acute rheumatic fever. I was in the hospital for a month and then 5 months at home in a hospital bed. And I'd been very athletic before that, and I was told, you'll never do that again. And, you know, and they pumped me full of steroids and all kinds of stuff. So I came out looking totally different. And it really could have messed up my life, something fierce. But because I read that book about Roy Campanella, that was my guidebook. Mm-hmm. And I learned to have a sense of humor. I learned to be grateful for everything, no pity parties, and to do whatever they told me to do. And that has gotten me through. And then I went to Elmhurst College, and my first day there, we were carrying my stuff up to the third floor, and my mom and I schlepping the stuff up, and they had names of all the new freshmen on their doors. There's Joni Campanella at the top of the stairs, and we went, wow, I wonder if she's related to Roy. It's his daughter. I just got an email from her 2 days ago. Wow. We were still really close friends, and she lives out in LA. And it wasn't till a few years ago that I told her how deeply I loved her father. And she said, why didn't you tell me? Because there was a kid in Ohio that near my hometown who was in a bad car accident when she was in grade school, and she ended up in a wheelchair. And her uncle was a fan of mine at the time. And then we got to be friends through this. He called me and said, could you write to her and send her some XRT Chotskys and encourage her? Then I found out a few years later, he said she's playing wheelchair basketball. And this is before the internet. So I called Tom Tuber, my Elmer's friend, and I said, can you get me a copy of It's Good to Be Alive? Because it was out of print. And he found one and sent it to me. So I went, next time I was in Ohio, I went to Greenville and met this girl and gave her the book. And I said, this book got me through rheumatic fever. And this is even closer to what you're going through, being in a wheelchair. And, you know, so I told Joni this story and she cried. She goes, why didn't you tell me this before? I said, because I didn't want to think you, I loved you just because your name's Campanella, you know. And we were really great friends, and all these years later. But that's why Roy Campanella meant so much.
That's wonderful. The one thing I did want to mention about Louis Armstrong was he's in the exhibit because
I saw that.
He had that period in Chicago that was very important. The Hot Five.
Very important.
So it was a museum insider thing. So I'm looking around for artifacts, and I reach out to their his foundation in New York, and they have got a trumpet to loan me, and I'm like very excited. And so I'm only in the preliminary stages of figuring out the logistics of everything. And then this new upstart museum in Memphis on African American history opens, and they jumped in line and got this trumpet before I So he called apologetic that this other museum had started. So we were supposed to have a Louis Armstrong trumpet in this exhibit, but that it happens in the museum field. So.
Right. Well, I have a good Louis Armstrong Chicago story for you. I tell my students a story about how he was in Chicago and they opened up a new studio in Richmond, Indiana that was supposed to be really good, and they wanted to go record there. But what happened, you know, they didn't have the and I go through Richmond every time I go from here to Ohio because I've made that trip way too many times. And I'll probably meet my maker on Highway 65 because it's a mess. And anyway, they didn't have super highways then and cars were slower. So it would take, right now, it'd take about 3 to 4 hours to get because it's further east from Indianapolis. But they had to drive all the way down there, which took a while. They recorded in that studio. They didn't spend the night. They got back in the car and drove to Chicago because the Ku Klux Klan was so prevalent there. They were afraid if they stayed overnight, they wouldn't get out of there alive. That, to me, and I tell that to my students, and it gives them chills, you know. Cause it, to me, the storytelling, that's why I love Langford so much. He makes up all of his stories, but they're really brilliant.
I'll just spend a couple of weeks traveling in Wales, and there's all these stories about Welsh history, and it's like, there's so many great stories, but there's some that contradict each other, and there's some that... But I kind of like just the story itself.
Stories bring things to life.
Something of meaning in it that maybe it's not exactly true, but
The meaning comes through.
Yeah, I'm just going to go back to your point about sports people and singers and people in entertainment and what happened with civil rights in Britain. We didn't know anything about the situation in America. As a kid, I was like, but I loved Muhammad Ali. I just worshipped him, and he was like a hero in Britain completely. And when what happened to him during the Vietnam War, it shocked people to the core in England. It revealed America to people in England in a way that it had just not been thought of before.
Sure,
that they would be punishing this guy that we thought was the greatest, and he was gorgeous and funny and brilliant, and everyone in Britain loved him, and it was a real turnaround, and it was of that age when I was becoming politically aware,
right?
And I really think the experience of following his career really, really explained America.
It teaches you a lot of life lessons, And I think that's why I think like this Summer of Soul movie is so important. And I even wrote about it on Facebook, and I was like on fire with it because I said, we know so little. Like the Tulsa thing, the 100th anniversary, how many people do you hear say, I didn't even know that happened? Well, it's because you don't teach it. Yeah. No. And I like majored in black history and literature at Elmhurst because they started offering these classes the last 2 years. And my grade point, I went from academic probation to dean's list because I was fascinated and I did all my homework. I was there every week, because I didn't know any of this stuff. It was all these writers and all this history, and it was all new to me. And I thought, why weren't we learning? And that's why I think it's important to have that stuff because you need to know. And you hear the argument now about, well, if we teach that, then the kids will hate America. I said, no, I know all that stuff and I love America, and I want to make America live up to its potential.
That's what we were talking about last night, you and I, and then we were also talking with Lance. I mean, how fluid is the history telling story?
Well, this exhibition to me is like open my eyes to so things that and connections that I didn't, in the back of my mind, I might have thought there was something, there's stories there to explore in the future, but this is like putting it completely in focus, and you look at it and go like, wow, all this happened here in Illinois.
And in writing it, I mean, the little booklet you guys got and stuff, these are kind of glum times, I tried to be positive.
Yeah.
You see that? And again, in your experience with kids and stuff, I mean,
sure.
I try to keep it positive.
The kids keep me positive.
They do, really?
Their energy, they inspire me. And that's what I'm trying to do on Facebook, is to, especially when we were all locked down, to try to use music to help us connect with each other and help keep us sane. And in fact, I had a lot of people said, I write late at night and post it, and they said they get up and have their coffee in the morning, and that's the first thing they'd read, because that would set their tone for the day, because there's always a lesson, there's always a moral to the story, and there's, you know, there's hope. And without hope, you don't have anything. And that's why I find with music inspires me so much. You know, just going to hear the Chicago Symphony, you come out, just feel like, whoa, you feel smarter or something, you know, inspired, and you think, I can do this, you know. Music and the arts are so important, and that's why I think cutting the arts from school, you know, we wonder why we have so many problems in Inglewood and place like that now, because they don't have access to the arts. And think about how many kids found themselves in band or orchestra or being in a play, and they learn life skills that you can't teach in geometry. Geometry is important. I sucked at it, but anyway, but all this other stuff, and to build community, and to teach kids how to fail and get up and do it again. And the same thing with sports, you know, those life disciplines. And we were just talking about this in the car on the way up too. We had a lot to talk about our way down here today. But I tell them, I said, you know, kids need to have a community outside their family. And they can either be in a gang or they could be in a choir. But if we don't provide them a choir, they don't have a choice. And they learn the same, they get the same support system, the same, you know, I mean, anybody that was in school, bands and orchestras, you know, and church choirs and stuff. I'm still, my best friends are still the people I was in church choir with 20 years ago. You know, they're the ones, we're there for each other through every hard thing in life that comes along. And music brings people together like that. It builds community. My mother taught me that, because she was a musician. And she started a community chorus in Piqua, Ohio, this little town. And we made great music. And it was everything from the president of the bank to a farmer to black and white, which was unusual then, high school kids and senior citizens, people that could...
How big was Piqua?
22,000. But there were people that could barely read music, and two opera cast members down in Dayton who would make that drive 25 miles each way. And they were brilliant musicians, but they loved singing with this community chorus. This to them was like folk music, you know. It was and she had a potluck dinner every year, and we build community around food and music. And as a child, I would go and act like I was doing my homework while I was really watching the rehearsals, and I was fascinated by it. And I saw these people connect that ordinarily wouldn't.
Well, every town in Wales, every little mining village, every place that's, you know, well, the industry shut down, has a choir. And you know,
remember that group you brought over here?
Yeah,
that
the men's choir, the Burlingtons from
Canada. God, I love them. They were, you know, I went to the Hideout
exactly
to see
what you,
guys.
Said. It's totally egalitarian. Yeah. It's more of a, it's a social community group. It's not down. You don't get in because you can sing well.
It's a drinking club.
Yeah.
Come on.
If you can, you have a few guys who can sing well, and the guys who can't sing very well, they stand next to the guys who can sing well, and they try and imitate what they're doing.
Sure.
And that's what makes the sound.
I know.
And it's a community thing. It's not. It's not a meritocracy. It's
no,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's just.
Well, my mom did a church choir, and she had an alto who was just awful. This old lady who was just, and you know, and I had a choir director that would have humiliated her in front of the whole choir. My mom pulled her aside and said, can you do me a big favor? I really need your help. She goes, oh, Betty, anything. She said, I have so many altos, they're drowning out the tenors and the basses. We need, so I'm going to ask all the altos, just pull back a little bit, just sing quieter. And, you know, but I want you to sing. I want you to be here. And she goes, oh, I'd be glad to help. And mom said she could never hear her sticking out again. And the woman still got to show up every week and be part of that community. And that's exactly what your guys in Wales are doing. You know, I mean, it builds community. It changes you. It makes you better, I think.
Well, we can. I only have a couple more questions. I know you got another thing to do out there.
I have a thing to do out there.
Oh, the show must go on.
But we touched on this, and it goes again in line with community. How come you think Chicago has never really done anything like this in a museum or because. And we talked before we started, went on the air with this. I mean, and I do see what they do at Stax with outreach and sending the Stax kids to London to sing on a recreation of the Stax.
Right.
And, you know, or you could have kids go to a museum where they could learn technical stuff and learn how to do a studio and stuff. Mm-hmm. Why has Chicago failed in this?
Well, that's a good question, but I think some of it's money, you know, but they need to have the will to do it, because like when you go to Nashville or go to Memphis or go to Detroit, they've got the Motown Museum now, you know.
They're expanding. Were we talking about that?
Yeah, yeah, right.
I just went to Motown Museum. It's fantastic.
Right, and, you know, we got to get busy here because it's tourist money. If they're talking about money, they could make money. You have to spend money to make money. Yeah. And you got, like, I it drives me nuts when every other year they say, well, are we going to save Muddy Waters House or not? You know, save it for crying out loud.
And do so. Yeah,
it's going to take some money and stuff. But that stuff is so important. And that's the way you get a lot of kids into it too. You know, they can't all take my class, you know. I can only have 20 kids a semester, but you know, to go into a museum or something like that. And in fact, Isaac Hayes, speaking of Memphis and Stax, Isaac Hayes spoke in my class once years ago.
Did he really?
And that was one of the highlights of my life. And that fell into my lap. I can't even take credit for it. But somebody who brought Al Cooper to my class once because he was in town on a Monday night and she loved it. So she was supposed to escort Isaac around. He came to town. He was trying to make a comeback, and he wanted to meet with all the executives at the urban black stations. They called it urban instead of black. That was a marketing thing. But anyway, I used to work at BMX because I came back. That was OPA, and their main frustration is they could sell hair care products and all that makeup and stuff, but like the airlines, the grocery store chains, they didn't know that black people flew on airplanes and went to the grocery to buy food. You know, so they called it urban. So it was less, anyway. But he was going to meet with all the executives from Chicago urban labels, radio stations. And so she said, can I bring him by your class before that? Because it's, we could move it back a little bit. I said, sure. So I opened it up to the whole campus because I thought, this is Isaac Hayes. They need to hear his story. That's how I introduced him, and he was in hysterics because I said, you know, you heard of the Godfather of Soul, and I went down to the Litany of the Saints there, and I said, but tonight we had the Black Moses, and he came out laughing. He said, I haven't heard that in a long time, but he didn't have the chains and the bare chest thing. But before he went out there, he was terrified. He was really nervous, and I said, Isaac, it's really going to be okay. All you got to do is tell your story, and if you run out of stuff, the kids will ask you questions. They've got a lot of questions. I said, because I told them to each have two questions just in case, and also to bring in the Hot Buttered Soul album and have you autograph it, because I said you were probably conceived to this album.
Yeah, sure.
You know? And then I explained about how in lovemaking, you know, side one ends and you have to go, whoops, I'll be right back, and jump out of bed, turn it over, put it on side two, boom. And so I told Isaac, I said, and we talk about Jim Crow South and all the civil rights movement in the 60s, because this was all happening. And I said, you lived it. Tell the stories. And he got out, and he was still nervous. He was really petrified. So I finally had to make him laugh. So I said, when I was at Elmhurst College, I was a speech major, and we had an oral interp class where we were supposed to read something that somebody wrote, you know, and you know, perform it, like. And for our final, you couldn't do a question and answer thing. So we had the theater building for one night, and we had to each pick something and perform. And I thought, nobody's going to come to this. I wouldn't go to this, you know. And it was packed. And I was like, oh my God. I chose to do the monologue by the time I get to Phoenix from Hot Buttered Soul.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And it was a brand new album. And people are doing, Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus, and To Be or Not to Be, that is, you know. And well, I did a Nancy Drew mystery story once during class and brought the place down. But I said, I was at the campus station. I was writing on a legal pad, you know, the whole thing. And I had to take
like 18
tone up.
Minutes long.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, except the monologue's not the whole song. So anyway. But I wrote it out, and then I got up there, and I thought, okay, now, you don't camp this up too much. Don't try to sound black. Just do it. And I did it. And you're like, you hurt me, baby. You hurt me. And all my black friends in the audience were, like, literally pushing each other off the chairs. They were on the floor, and they were like, hitting each other, laughing so hard. It brought the house down. And but I still stayed true to it. You know. But I told him, and Isaac laughed like, you know, crazy. He just, he was so taken by that story. And that kind of lightened it up a little bit. And then when I did the Black Moses thing, then he was ready to go. And then the kids were just focused on him. He told a story that I know they'll never forget too, that he was playing in this band in Memphis. He played Hammond B3 organ, and he wasn't even the vocalist in this group. It was a local group. It was before his Stax days. And one night, the band leader, before they went on, said, "Isaac, you sing a song tonight, anything you want." And we gave him a keyboard, and I said, "We're not paying you, so you don't have to play anything. You just there if you want it." And he went over to it and started playing while he's telling the story. And he said, "There was this white woman that would come to the club a lot, and it was all white people on the main floor, and the balcony. And he was blacks, you know." And he said that she came there frequently, and they had this eye contact thing. He said, "I don't know her name, never spoke to her, because I said I didn't want to die." And he said, you know, but we had this real emotional attraction to each other. And that night, I sang her this song. He's playing around, and he goes into My Funny Valentine. And the kids quit breathing. I mean, they just went,
wow.
And he sang the whole song, like real beautiful ballad. And he said, "We made eye contact through that whole song." He said, "I've had a lot of sex in my life. Nothing like I felt then."
Wow.
He said, "I'll never forget that." And so he's talking about music and racism and bringing it all together. Yeah, right. And that's teaching. And so at the end of the thing, we were saying goodbye. And he stayed and autographed till he was late to meet all these big radio muck-mucks, you know. Yeah. But he said, "I'm not leaving till I autograph everything." And bless his heart. And he said, "You know, I learned something tonight." He said, "You're right. They do need to hear these stories. And I'm going to do this." Right? And I found out that he did a lot of that. He went around to colleges and universities telling those stories. And I was so thrilled that he got the inspiration there.
Well, that's what we're doing here. These podcasts are oral histories. I mean, you've been so generous with your time, and John. I mean, it's important stuff for people to have. And they'll be around forever, close to forever. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we inspire each other with those stories. I get inspired by other people's stories, and then pass them on to my students, and they pass them on to, and that's as old as the Old Testament, you know, telling stories, you know.
Do you have any other questions? I got one question.
Okay.
You guys can get anything else you want?
Any questions?
I got one. I asked you questions that you never heard. I'm going to ask her a question.
Go on, you ask her a question.
No, you've had this question a million times.
Okay.
But no, go ahead.
Okay.
No, go on. You.
What's your favorite Beatles song?
Gee, I never even thought about that.
Because Dave's going to sing it for you right now. Whatever it is.
Is he?
Yeah. That's not going to happen.
Because I'm starting to get a little worried when you said that. Actually, it's been the same one since 1965. I'm kind of stuck on In My Life.
Yeah, well, that's a good call.
That is a song, and that is one of those songs that gets you through life, you know? And my sister was killed in an auto accident when she was 19, way at college, and it just broke our hearts. She was 13 years younger than me, so she was my baby. Wow. And big Beatle fan. I don't know how that happened. But anyway, my other sister, who was 2 years older than her, Paul McCartney kissed her at the White House when I brought her there to see the Gershwin Awards, and she'll never forget it. And so she owes me big time for that. But no, she loves it. On her wedding day, she told her husband, said, "This is the second best day of my life." And he goes, "I know, Paul McCartney kissing you at the wedding." But Joni was a big Beatle fan too. And we were gathered around the table putting together all the stuff you have to put together at a time like that. And my mom said, "We need a poem to put on the back of her mass card." And I said, "Joni wouldn't know a book of poetry if it bit her in the rear end, you know?" And she was not a poetry fan. And I said, "I think maybe a Beatle lyric." And she goes, "Oh, no, that wouldn't be appropriate." And so I left the room. My mom had, like, dresser drawers, like, you know, old antique dresser drawers with open up sheet music, just drawers and drawers of sheet music. And I found my old Beatle piano books I'd had when I was growing up there. And I opened up to In My Life and put it down in front of her. And she read it and she went, perfect. Wow. So that was on her funeral card. Wow. And my mom never heard the song until a couple years later, my family came out to visit. And it was the whole family, my parents and siblings and everybody. And this priest friend of mine heard that they were coming and said, do you want me to come and do a mass at your house for Joni? Or just do a mass for Joni? And I thought he would just mention her name. And he meant at my home. So I said, okay, what do I need? You know, said, just a candle. Don't make it look like a church. And he said, but have a piece of music for the reflection after the communion. So I had my cassette deck all set up. This is in the 80s. Yeah, right. And so after communion, when you're sitting kind of meditating, I popped that in, and that's the first time my mother heard the song, and she immediately recognized it from the words. And that song has just got me through a lot of things in life. And here's John Lennon writing this when he's so young. Same like with Paul. I asked Paul once, I said, you wrote Yesterday when you were a kid, and you didn't, it's about loss, and you didn't know nothing about loss. Now you do. You know, you've lost both your parents, Linda, you know, John, and, you know, you really know loss intimately. I said, when you sing that now as a grown man on stage, does that ever hit you? Does that song ever come back and just bite your bum, you know? Yeah, and he said, there are some times when I come this close to crying and I have to pull back. I have to go, whoa, Nelly, nobody paid to see an old man up here crying, you know? And I said, I think we'd understand. We'd be gentle with you. But he says that he has to pull back sometimes because he starts thinking about it. And then he gets choked up.
Well, Terry, you got an old man like me crying.
Oh, no. Sorry.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Dave. It was a
Roy
pleasure.
The Roy Campanella story, I'll never forget.
I'll tell Joni. Yeah.
That's great.
Oh, can I tell you one more quick one?
Sure, yeah.
Mary Wilson of the Supremes. I love Mary and Flo. I could care less about Diana Ross, whatever. Mary and Flo were mine. And I was a big Flo fan. And we had to Zoom Beetlefest 2 years ago. And Mary was going to come, because they covered some Beatles songs and knew the Beatles, and she was going to be a guest, and she couldn't come, so I had a one-hour Zoom with her. It's actually on the internet. It's worth seeing. She was amazing. I'd never met her. Just boom, there you are. And like 2 minutes into it, she was just being so funny. She dressed up. She lived in Las Vegas, and she had some of her costumes that she couldn't use because of COVID. And so she dressed up for this. I said, you look great. I said, give us a twirl. And so she got up and did a twirl, and we were off to the races. And towards the end of the interview, I told her about Joni Campanella. I said, you knew Roy Campanella, because all the sports and music people knew each other because they looked out after, like when traveling from city to city, a lot of times they'd stay in each other's homes, you know. And so I figured she knew the Campanellas. And I said, I walked into Heaven on 7 once with Joni Campanella, and one of the Buckets, who was Taye Diggs' mother, actually, small world. Yeah, and we walked into Heaven on 7, and the waiter knew me and pulled me aside. He said, is that Mary Wilson of the Supremes with you? And I said, no, but it's Roy Campanella's daughter, if you're a baseball fan. And so, anyway, every time I told Joni, and she thought it was hysterical, anytime she'd send me a picture, I'd say, who's that with Mary Wilson of the Supremes? And, you know, so I told Mary Wilson this story, and she goes, I want to meet her. I said, she was planning on flying out here for this Beetlefest this year, but she said, well, I'm going to do it next year. Let's do it. And I said, well, I'll get her to come out here because I want pictures of the two of you together. And then, of course, she died just a couple months after that, suddenly, and it broke my heart. But the weird thing is, I was just getting ready to go to bed. It was like 1 a.m. I looked at my cell phone just to see if I missed anything. Joni Campanella had just emailed me to tell me that Mary Wilson died. And, you know, and I just thought, to hear it from her, that was just too cosmic. Yeah. And, Mary Wilson is just one of the coolest people I ever talked to. And also Sarah Dash of LaBelle just died this week. Right. And I interviewed her back in the 70s, and getting to interview, you know, as a fan, talking to these people and getting stories out of them. And she told me all about the Chitlin circuit and all that. It was just amazing. But so, yeah, I feel very lucky to have this career because I did meet two of the Beatles, and I've met everybody who's ever married to a Beatle. And you know, and I can't say everybody.
Louise Harrison, right?
Oh, yeah, Lou and I, yeah.
Story on that house once.
Oh, yeah, Lou, we're good buddies. Yeah. So, but it's a real pleasure, and everybody should see all your documentaries and Springfield and the Staples. When will we ever get to see at Staples Singers one again?
I know. I don't know if there's. I know some of it's on YouTube. We're talking about Dylan, but Dylan was so nice to give us an interview for that. But then. I was going to ask you about that with the radio, too, because he would always talk in that documentary. He talks about the magic of radio when he would hear Pop's tremolo guitar going across the skies to Minnesota and stuff. But I think the versions on YouTube, his people took him out. And so I don't think it'll ever be like a DVD, really. We did that for Channel 11, but I think
that was great. I'll never
find some of it on YouTube.
That night at Fitzgerald's was the first night I met Mavis.
Yeah, wasn't that something?
Oh, my God. Yeah. And Jesse Dixon. I was so excited.
Well, and then you did one of those shows, right? One of the were you there that night?
I was there. Well, you had your book launch.
We did the book thing, Mavis.
No, we were talking about that earlier when Mavis is singing Dave Hoekstra and said, "I'll take you there." Yeah. She's singing Dave Hoekstra. she's game, Mavis. Yeah, she's great.
Well, I'm here with two people I'm big fans of, both of you.
I'll take that as a compliment.
And you know thank I you. Mean it, too. So
I
want to
thank you guys. You guys are treasures, and thanks for being so generous with your time. John Langford.
Good luck with the rest of the time of the exhibits up. I hope you have loads of big crowds.
I wish I could bring my class down here. Yeah. It's a long drive. Yeah. But I found out they can take Amtrak, so I'm going to tell them to come. Yeah. They'll get extra credit.
We think you got to bring the exhibition to Chicago.
That would be nice.
Nice.
You should.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. We need to find a venue.
Yeah. That's what, yeah. We're talking
about. A lot of artifacts are going to want them back at one point.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lance, for putting all this together. And thank you,
Blue
Terry.
Blue Jays, yeah.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.